limits the tether of what can or cannot be done for land. It always has, and it always will. The fallacy the economic determinists have tied around our collective neck, and which we now need to cast off, is the belief that economics determines all land use. This is simply not true. An innumerable host of actions and attitudes, comprising perhaps the bulk of all land relations, is determined by the land user's tastes and predilections, rather than by his purse. The bulk of all land relations hinges on investments of time, forethought, skill, and faith, rather than on investments of cash. As a land user thinketh, so is he. I have purposely presented the land ethic as a product of social evolution, because nothing so important as an ethic is ever written. Only the most superficial student of history supposes that Moses wrote the Decalogue. It evolved in the minds of a thinking community, and Moses wrote a tentative summary of it for a seminar. I say tentative because evolution never stops. The evolution of a land ethic is an intellectual as well as emotional process. Conservation is paved with good intentions which prove to be futile or even dangerous because they are devoid of critical understanding either of the land or of economic land use. I think it is a truism that as the ethical frontier advances from the individual to the community, its intellectual content increases. The mechanism of operation is the same for any ethic. Social approbation for right actions, social disapproval for wrong actions. By and large, our present problem is one of attitudes and implements. We are remodeling the Alhambra with a steam shovel, and we are proud of our yardage. We shall hardly relinquish the shovel, which, after all, has many good points, but we are in need of gentler and more objective criteria for its successful use. Wilderness. Wilderness is the raw material out of which man has hammered the artifact called civilization. Wilderness was never a homogeneous raw material. It was very diverse, and the resulting artifacts are very diverse. These differences in the end product are known as cultures. The rich diversity of the world's cultures reflects a corresponding diversity in the wilds that gave them birth. For the first time in the history of the human species, two changes are now impending. One is the exhaustion of wilderness in the more habitable portions of the globe. The other is the worldwide hybridization of cultures through modern transport and industrialization. Neither can be prevented, and perhaps should not be. But the question arises whether, by some slight amelioration of the impending changes, certain values can be preserved that would otherwise be lost. To the laborer in the sweat of his labor, the raw stuff on his anvil is an adversary to be conquered. So was wilderness an adversary to the pioneer. But to the laborer in repose, able for the moment to cast a philosophical eye on his world, that same raw stuff is something to be loved and cherished, because it gives definition and meaning to his life. This is a plea for the preservation of some tag ends of wilderness, as museum pieces, for the edification of those who may one day wish to see, feel, or study the origins of their cultural inheritance. The remnants. Many of the diverse wildernesses out of which we have hammered America are already gone. Hence, in any practical program, the unit areas to be preserved must vary greatly in size and in degree of wildness. No living man will see again the long grass prairie, where a sea of prairie flowers lapped at the stirrups of the pioneer. We shall do well to find a 40 here and there on which the prairie plants can be kept alive as species. There were 100 such plants, many of exceptional beauty. Most of them are quite unknown to those who have inherited their domain. But the short grass prairie, where Cabeza de Vaca saw the horizon under the bellies of the buffalo, is still extant in a few spots of 10,000-acre size, albeit severely chewed up by sheep, cattle, and dry farmers. If the 49ers are worth commemorating on the walls of state capitals, is not the scene of their mighty hegira worth commemorating in several national prairie reservations? No living man will see again the virgin pineries of the lake states, or the flat woods of the coastal plain, or the giant hardwoods. Of these, samples of a few acres each will have to suffice. But there are still several blocks of maple hemlock of 1,000-acre size. There are similar blocks of Appalachian hardwoods, of southern hardwood swamp, of cypress swamp, and of Adirondack spruce. Few of these tag ends are secure from prospective cuttings, and fewer still from prospective tourist roads. One of the fastest shrinking categories of wilderness is coastlines. Cottages and tourist roads have all but annihilated wild coasts on both oceans, and Lake Superior is now losing the large last remnant of wild shoreline on the Great Lakes. No single kind of wilderness is more intimately interwoven with history, and none nearer the point of complete disappearance. In all of North America, east of the Rockies, there is only one large area formerly reserved as a wilderness, the Quetico Superior International Park in Minnesota and Ontario. This magnificent block of canoe country, a mosaic of lakes and rivers, lies mostly in Canada and can be about as large as Canada chooses to make it. But its integrity is threatened by two recent developments, the growth of fishing resorts served by pontoon-equipped airplanes, and a jurisdictional dispute whether the Minnesota end of the area shall be all national forest or partly state forest. The whole region is in danger of power impoundments, and this regrettable cleavage among proponents of wilderness may end in giving power the whip hand. In the Rocky Mountain states, a score of areas in the national forests, varying in size from 100,000 to 500,000 acres, are withdrawn as wilderness and closed to roads, hotels, and other inimical uses. In the national parks, the same principle is recognized, but no specific boundaries are delimited. Collectively, these federal areas are the backbone of the wilderness program, but they are not so secure as the paper record might lead one to believe. Local pressures for new tourist roads knock off a chip here and a slab there. There is perennial pressure for extension of roads for forest fire control, and these, by slow degrees, become public highways. Idle CCC camps presented a widespread temptation to build new and often needless roads. Lumber shortages during the war gave the impetus of military necessity to many road extensions, legitimate or otherwise. At the present moment, ski tows and ski hotels are being promoted in many mountain areas, often without regard to their prior designation as wilderness. One of the most insidious invasions of wilderness is via predator control. It works thus. Wolves and lions are cleaned out of a wilderness area in the interest of big game management. The big game herds, usually deer or elk, then increase to the point of over-browsing the range. Hunters must then be encouraged to harvest the surplus. But modern hunters refuse to operate far from a car. Hence, a road must be built to provide access to the surplus game. Again and again, wilderness areas have been split by this process, but it still continues. The Rocky Mountain system of wilderness areas covers a wide gamut of forest types, from the juniper brakes of the Southwest to the illimitable woods where rolls the Oregon. It is lacking, however, in desert areas, probably because of that underaged brand of aesthetics which limits the definition of scenery to lakes and pine trees. In Canada and Alaska, there are still large expanses of virgin country, where nameless men by nameless rivers wander and in strange valleys die strange deaths alone. A representative series of these areas can and should be kept. Many are of negligible or negative value for economic use. It will be contended, of course, that no deliberate planning to this end is necessary, that adequate areas will survive anyhow. All recent history belies so comforting an assumption. Even if wild spots do survive, what of their fauna? The woodland caribou, the several races of mountain sheep, the pure form of woods buffalo, the barren ground grizzly, the freshwater seals, and the whales are even now threatened. Of what use are wild areas destitute of their distinctive faunas? There are now organizations and development groups actively embarked on the industrialization of the Arctic wastes, and plans even larger are actively being pressed. The wilderness of the far north as yet has no formal protection, and though still extensive, is beginning to dwindle. To what extent Canada and Alaska will be able to see and grasp their opportunities is anybody's guess. Pioneers usually scoff at any effort to perpetuate pioneering. Wilderness for recreation. Physical combat for the means of subsistence was, for unnumbered centuries, an economic fact. When it disappeared as such, a sound instinct led us to preserve it in the form of athletic sports and games. Physical combat between men and beasts was, in like manner, an economic fact, now preserved as hunting and fishing for sport. Public wilderness areas are, first of all, a means of perpetuating, in sport form, the more virile and primitive skills in pioneering travel and subsistence. Some of these skills are of generalized distribution. The details have been adapted to the American scene, but the skill is worldwide. Hunting, fishing, and foot travel by pack are examples. Two of them, however, are as American as a hickory tree. They have been copied elsewhere, but they were developed to their full perfection only on this continent. One of these is canoe travel, and the other is travel by pack train. Both are shrinking rapidly. Your Hudson Bay Indian now has a putt-putt, and your mountaineer a Ford. If I had to make a living by canoe or pack horse, I should likely do likewise, for both are grueling labor. But we who seek wilderness travel for sport are foiled when we are forced to compete with mechanized substitutes. It is bootless to execute a portage to the tune of motor launches, or to turn out your bell mare in the pasture of a summer hotel. It is better to stay home. Wilderness areas are, first of all, a series of sanctuaries for the primitive arts of wilderness travel, especially canoeing and packing. I suppose some will wish to debate whether it is important to keep these primitive arts alive. I shall not debate it. Either you know it in your bones, or you are very, very old. European hunting and fishing are largely devoid of the thing that wilderness areas might be the means of preserving in this country. Europeans do not camp, cook, or do their own work in the woods if they can avoid doing so. Work chores are delegated to beaters and servants, and a hunt carries the atmosphere of a picnic rather than of pioneering. The test of skill is confined largely to the actual taking of game or fish. There are those who decry wilderness sports as undemocratic, because the recreational carrying capacity of a wilderness is small as compared with a golf links or a tourist camp. The basic error in such argument is that it applies the philosophy of mass production to what is intended to counteract mass production. The value of recreation is not a matter of ciphers. Recreation is valuable in proportion to the intensity of its experiences and to the degree by which it differs from and contrasts with workaday life. By these criteria, mechanized outings are at best a milk and water affair. Mechanized recreation already has seized 9/10 of the woods and mountains. A decent respect for minorities should dedicate the other 10th to wilderness. Wilderness for science. The most important characteristic of an organism is that capacity for internal self-renewal known as health. There are two organisms whose processes of self-renewal have been subjected to human interference and control. One of these is man himself, medicine and public health. The other is land, agriculture and conservation. The effort to control the health of land has not been very successful. It is now generally understood that when soil loses fertility or washes away faster than it forms, and when water systems exhibit abnormal floods and shortages, the land is sick. Other derangements are known as facts, but are not yet thought of as symptoms of land sickness. The disappearance of plants and animal species without visible cause, despite efforts to protect them, and the eruption of others as pests, despite efforts to control them, must, in the absence of simpler explanations, be regarded as symptoms of sickness in the land organism. Both are occurring too frequently to be dismissed as normal evolutionary events. The status of thought on these ailments of the land is reflected in the fact that our treatments for them are still prevailingly local. Thus, when a soil loses fertility, we pour on fertilizer, or at best alter its tame flora and fauna, without considering the fact that its wild flora and fauna, which built the soil to begin with, may likewise be important to its maintenance. It was recently discovered, for example, that good tobacco crops depend, for some unknown reason, on the preconditioning of the soil by wild ragweed. It does not occur to us that such unexpected chains of dependency may have wide prevalence in nature. When prairie dogs, ground squirrels, or mice increase to pest levels, we poison them. But we do not look beyond the animal to find the cause of the eruption. We assume that animal troubles must have animal causes. The latest scientific evidence points to derangements of the plant community as the real seat of rodent eruptions, but few explorations of this clue are being made. Many forest plantations are producing one-log or two-log trees on soil which originally grew three-log and four-log trees. Why? Thinking foresters know that the cause probably lies not in the tree, but in the microflora of the soil, and that it may take more years to restore the soil flora than it took to destroy it. Many conservation treatments are obviously superficial. Flood control dams have no relation to the cause of floods. Check dams and terraces do not touch the cause of erosion. Refuges and hatcheries to maintain the supply of game and fish do not explain why the supply fails to maintain itself. In general, the trend of the evidence indicates that in land, just as in the human body, the symptoms may lie in one organ and the cause in another. The practices we now call conservation are, to a large extent, local alleviations of biotic pain. They are necessary, but they must not be confused with cures. The art of land doctoring is being practiced with vigor, but the science of land health is yet to be born. A science of land health needs, first of all, a base datum of normality, a picture of how healthy land maintains itself as an organism. We have two available norms. One is found where land physiology remains largely normal despite centuries of human occupation. I know of only one such place, northeastern Europe. It is not likely that we shall fail to study it. The other and most perfect norm is wilderness. Paleontology offers abundant evidence that wilderness maintained itself for immensely long periods, that its component species were rarely lost, neither did they get out of hand, that weather and water built soil as fast or faster than it was carried away. Wilderness, then, assumes unexpected importance as a laboratory for the study of land health. One cannot study the physiology of Montana in the Amazon. Each biotic province needs its own wilderness for comparative studies of used and unused land. It is, of course, too late to salvage more than a lopsided system of wilderness study areas, and most of these remnants are far too small to retain their normality in all respects. Even the national parks, which run up to 1 million acres each in size, have not been large enough to retain their natural predators or to exclude animal diseases carried by livestock. Thus, the Yellowstone has lost its wolves and cougars, with the result that elk are ruining the flora, particularly on the winter range. At the same time, the grizzly bear and the mountain sheep are shrinking, the latter by reason of disease. While even the largest wilderness areas become partially deranged, it required only a few wild acres for J.E. Weaver to discover why the prairie flora is more drought-resistant than the agronomic flora which has supplanted it. Weaver found that the prairie species practice teamwork underground by distributing their root systems to cover all levels, whereas the species comprising the agronomic rotation overdraw one level and neglect another, thus building up cumulative deficits. An important agronomic principle emerged from Weaver's researches. Again, it required only a few wild acres for Togrediak to discover why pines on old fields never achieve the size or wind firmness of pines on uncleared forest soils. In the latter case, the roots follow old root channels and thus strike deeper. In many cases, we literally do not know how good a performance to expect of healthy land unless we have a wild area for comparison with sick ones. Thus, most of the early travelers in the Southwest describe the mountain rivers as originally clear. But a doubt remains, for they may, by accident, have seen them at favorable seasons. Erosion engineers had no base datum until it was discovered that exactly similar rivers in the Sierra Madre of Chihuahua, never grazed or used for fear of Indians, show at their worst a milky hue, not too cloudy for a trout fly. Moss grows to the water's edge on their banks. Most of the corresponding rivers in Arizona and New Mexico are ribbons of boulders, mossless, soilless, and all but treeless. The preservation and study of the Sierra Madre wilderness by an international experiment station as a norm for the cure of sick land on both sides of the border would be a good neighbor enterprise well worthy of consideration. In short, all available wild areas, large or small, are likely to have value as norms for land science. Recreation is not their only or even their principal utility. Wilderness for wildlife. The national parks do not suffice as a means of perpetuating the larger carnivores. Witness the precarious status of the grizzly bear and the fact that the park system is already wolfless. Neither do they suffice for mountain sheep. Most sheep herds are shrinking. The reasons for this are clear in some cases and obscure in others. The parks are certainly too small for such a far-ranging species as the wolf. Many animal species, for reasons unknown, do not seem to thrive as detached islands of population. The most feasible way to enlarge the area available for wilderness fauna is for the wilder parts of the national forests, which usually surround the parks, to function as parks in respect to threatened species. That they have not so functioned is tragically illustrated in the case of the grizzly bear. In 1909, when I first saw the West, there were grizzlies in every major mountain mass, but you could travel for months without meeting a conservation officer. Today, there is some kind of conservation officer behind every bush, yet as wildlife bureaus grow, our most magnificent mammal retreats steadily toward the Canadian border. Of the 6,000 grizzlies officially reported as remaining in areas owned by the United States, 5,000 are in Alaska. Only 5 states have any at all. There seems to be a tacit assumption that if grizzlies survive in Canada and Alaska, that is good enough. It is not good enough for me. The Alaskan bears are a distinct species. Relegating grizzlies to Alaska is about like relegating happiness to heaven. One may never get there. Saving the grizzly requires a series of large areas from which roads and livestock are excluded, or in which livestock damage is compensated. Buying out scattered livestock ranches is the only way to create such areas, but despite large authority to buy and exchange lands, the conservation bureaus have accomplished virtually nothing toward this end. The Forest Service has established a grizzly range in Montana, but I know of a mountain range in Utah in which the Forest Service actually promoted a sheep industry, despite the fact that it harbored the sole remnant of grizzlies in that state. Permanent grizzly ranges and permanent wilderness areas are, of course, two names for one problem. Enthusiasm about either requires a long view of conservation and a historical perspective. Only those able to see the pageant of evolution can be expected to value its theater, the wilderness, or its outstanding achievement, the grizzly. But if education really educates, there will, in time, be more and more citizens who understand that relics of the Old West add meaning and value to the new. Youth, yet unborn, will pull up the Missouri with Lewis and Clark, or climb the Sierras with James Capen Adams, and each generation in turn will ask, "Where is the big white bear?" It will be a sorry answer to say he went under while conservationists weren't looking. Defenders of Wilderness. Wilderness is a resource which can shrink but not grow. Invasions can be arrested or modified in a manner to keep an area usable either for recreation or for science or for wildlife, but the creation of new wilderness in the full sense of the word is impossible. It follows, then, that any wilderness program is a rearguard action through which retreats are reduced to a minimum. The Wilderness Society was organized in 1935 for the one purpose of saving the wilderness remnants in America. The Sierra Club is doing yeoman work toward the same end. It does not suffice, however, to have a few such societies, nor can one be content that Congress has enacted a bill aimed at wilderness preservation. Unless there be wilderness-minded men scattered through all the conservation bureaus, the societies may never learn of new invasions until the time for action has passed. Furthermore, a militant minority of wilderness-minded citizens must be on watch throughout the nation and vigilantly available for action. In Europe, where wilderness has now retreated to the Carpathians and Siberia, every thinking conservationist bemoans its loss. Even in Britain, which has less room for land luxuries than almost any other civilized country, there is a vigorous, if belated, movement for saving a few small spots of semi-wild land. Ability to see the cultural value of wilderness boils down, in the last analysis, to a question of intellectual humility. The shallow-minded modern, who has lost his rootage in the land, assumes that he has already discovered what is important. It is such who prate of empires, political or economic, that will last 1,000 years. It is only the scholar who appreciates that all history consists of successive excursions from a single starting point, to which man returns again and again to organize yet another search for a durable scale of values. It is only the scholar who understands why the raw wilderness gives definition and meaning to the human enterprise. Conservation aesthetic. Barring love and war, few enterprises are undertaken with such abandon or by such diverse individuals or with so paradoxical a mixture of appetite and altruism as that group of avocations known as outdoor recreation. It is, by common consent, a good thing for people to get back to nature. But wherein lies the goodness, and what can be done to encourage its pursuit? On these questions, there is confusion of counsel, and only the most uncritical minds are free from doubt. Recreation became a problem with a name in the days of the Elder Roosevelt, when the railroads, which had banished the countryside from the city, began to carry city dwellers en masse to the countryside. It began to be noticed that the greater the exodus, the smaller the per capita ration of peace, solitude, wildlife, and scenery, and the longer the migration to reach them. The automobile has spread this once mild and local predicament to the outermost limits of good roads. It has made scarce in the hinterlands something once abundant on the back 40. But that something must nevertheless be found. Like ions shot from the sun, the weekenders radiate from every town, generating heat and friction as they go. A tourist industry purveys bed and board to bait more ions faster, further. Advertisements on rock and rill confide to all and sundry the whereabouts of new retreats, landscapes, hunting grounds, and fishing lakes just beyond those recently overrun. Bureaus build roads into new hinterlands, then buy more hinterlands to absorb the exodus accelerated by the roads. A gadget industry pads the bumps against nature in the raw. Woodcraft becomes the art of using gadgets. And now, to cap the pyramid of banalities, the trailer. To him who seeks in the woods and mountains only those things obtainable from travel or golf, the present situation is tolerable. But to him who seeks something more, recreation has become a self-destructive process of seeking but never quite finding, a major frustration of mechanized society. The retreat of the wilderness under the barrage of motorized tourists is no local thing. Hudson Bay, Alaska, Mexico, South Africa are giving way, and South America and Siberia are next. Drums along the Mohawk are now honks along the rivers of the world. Homo sapiens putters no more under his own vine and fig tree. He has poured into his gas tank the stored motivity of countless creatures aspiring through the ages to wiggle their way to pastures new. Ant-like, he swarms the continents. This is outdoor recreation, latest model. Who now is the recreationist, and what does he seek? A few samples will remind us. Take a look, first, at any duck marsh. A cordon of parked cars surrounds it. Crouched on each point of its reedy margin is some pillar of society, automatic ready, trigger finger itching the brake if need be. Every law of commonwealth or commonweal to kill a duck. That he is already overfed in no way dampens his avidity for gathering his meat from God. Wandering in the nearby woods is another pillar, hunting rare ferns or new warblers. Because his kind of hunting seldom calls for theft or pillage, he disdains the killer. Yet, like as not, in his youth he was one. At some nearby resort is still another nature lover, the kind who writes bad verse on birch bark. Everywhere is the unspecialized motorist whose recreation is mileage, who has run the gamut of the national parks in one summer, and now is headed for Mexico City and points south. Lastly, there is the professional, striving through countless conservation organizations to give the nature-seeking public what it wants, or to make it want what he has to give. Why, it may be asked, should such a diversity of folk be bracketed in a single category? Because each, in his own way, is a hunter. And why does each call himself a conservationist? Because the wild things he hunts for have eluded his grasp, and he hopes, by some necromancy of laws, appropriations, regional plans, reorganization of departments, or other form of mass wishing, to make them stay put. Recreation is commonly spoken of as an economic resource. Senate committees tell us, in reverent ciphers, how many millions the public spends in its pursuit. It has indeed an economic aspect. A cottage on a fishing lake, or even a duck point on a marsh, may cost as much as the entire adjacent farm. It has also an ethical aspect. In the scramble for unspoiled places, codes and decalogues evolve. We hear of outdoor manners. We indoctrinate youth. We print definitions of what is a sportsman, and hang a copy on the wall of whosoever will pay a dollar for the propagation of the faith. It is clear, though, that these economic and ethical manifestations are results, not causes, of the motive force. We seek contacts with nature because we derive pleasure from them. As in opera, economic machinery is employed to create and maintain facilities, As in opera, professionals make a living out of creating and maintaining them. But it would be false to say of either that the basic motive, the raison d'être, is economic. The duck hunter in his blind and the operatic singer on the stage, despite the disparity of their accoutrements, are doing the same thing. Each is reviving, in play, a drama formerly inherent in daily life. Both are, in the last analysis, aesthetic exercises. Public policies for outdoor recreation are controversial. Equally conscientious citizens hold opposite views on what is and what should be done to conserve its resource base. Thus, the Wilderness Society seeks to exclude roads from the hinterlands and the Chamber of Commerce to extend them, both in the name of recreation. The game farmer kills hawks, and the bird lover protects them in the name of shotgun and field glass hunting, respectively. Such factions commonly label each other with short and ugly names, when, in fact, each is considering a different component of the recreational process. These components differ widely in their characteristics or properties. A given policy may be true for one, but false for another. It seems timely, therefore, to segregate the components and to examine the distinctive characteristics or properties of each. We begin with the simplest and most obvious, the physical objects that the outdoorsman may seek, find, capture, and carry away. In this category are wild crops such as game and fish, and the symbols or tokens of achievement such as heads, hides, photographs, and specimens. All these things rest upon the idea of trophy. The pleasure they give is, or should be, in the seeking as well as in the getting. The trophy, whether it be a bird's egg, a mass of trout, a basket of mushrooms, the photograph of a bear, the pressed specimen of a wildflower, or a note tucked into the kern on a mountain peak, is a certificate. It attests that its owner has been somewhere and done something, that he has exercised skill, persistence, or discrimination in the age-old feat of overcoming, outwitting, or reducing to possession. These connotations, which attach to the trophy, usually far exceed its physical value. But trophies differ in their reactions to mass pursuit. The yield of game and fish can, by means of propagation or management, be increased so as to give each hunter more, or to give more hunters the same amount. During the past decade, a profession of wildlife management has sprung into existence. A score of universities teach its techniques, conduct research for bigger and better wild animal crops. However, when carried too far, this stepping up of yields is subject to a law of diminishing returns. Very intensive management of game or fish lowers the unit value of the trophy by artificializing it. Consider, for example, a trout raised in a hatchery and newly liberated in an overfished stream. The stream is no longer capable of natural trout production. Pollution has fouled its waters, or deforestation and trampling have warmed or silted them. No one would claim that this trout has the same value as a wholly wild one caught out of some unmanaged stream in the high Rockies. Its aesthetic connotations are inferior, even though its capture may require skill. Its liver, one authority says, is also so degenerated by hatchery feeding as to forebode an early death. Yet several overfished states now depend almost entirely on such man-made trout. All intergrades of artificiality exist, but as mass use increases, it tends to push the whole gamut of conservation techniques toward the artificial end, and the whole scale of trophy values downward. To safeguard this expensive, artificial, and more or less helpless trout, the Conservation Commission feels impelled to kill all herons and terns visiting the hatchery where it was raised, and all mergansers and otters inhabiting the stream in which it was released. The fisherman perhaps feels no loss in this sacrifice of one kind of wildlife for another. but the ornithologist is ready to bite off 10-penny nails. Artificialized management has, in effect, bought fishing at the expense of another and perhaps higher recreation. It has paid dividends to one citizen out of capital stock belonging to all. The same kind of biological wildcatting prevails in game management. In Europe, where wild crop statistics are available for long periods, we even know the rate of exchange of game for predators. Thus, in Saxony, one hawk is killed for each 7 game birds bagged, and one predator of some kind for each 3 head of small game. Damage to plant life usually follows artificialized management of animals. For example, damage to forests by deer. One may see this in North Germany, in northeast Pennsylvania, in the Kaibab, and in dozens of other less publicized regions. In each case, overabundant deer, when deprived of their natural enemies, have made it impossible for deer food plants to survive or reproduce. Beech, maple, and yew in Europe, ground hemlock and white cedar in the eastern states, mountain mahogany and cliff rose in the west, are deer foods threatened by artificialized deer. The composition of the flora, from wildflowers to forest trees, is gradually impoverished, and the deer, in turn, are dwarfed by malnutrition. There are no stags in the woods today, like those whose antlers decorated the walls of feudal castles. On the English heaths, reproduction of trees is inhibited by rabbits overprotected in the process of cropping partridges and pheasants. On scores of tropical islands, both flora and fauna have been destroyed by goats introduced for meat and sport. It would be hard to calculate the mutual injuries by and between mammals deprived of their natural predators, and ranges stripped of their natural food plants. Agricultural crops, caught between these upper and nether millstones of ecological mismanagement, are saved only at the cost of endless indemnities and barbed wire. We generalize, then, by saying that mass use tends to dilute the quality of organic trophies like game and fish, and to induce damage to other resources such as non-game animals, natural vegetation, and farm crops. The same dilution and damage is not apparent in the yield of indirect trophies, such as photographs. Broadly speaking, a piece of scenery snapped by a dozen tourist cameras daily is not physically impaired thereby, nor does it suffer if photographed 100 times. The camera industry is one of the few innocuous parasites on wild nature. We have, then, a basic difference in reaction to mass use as between two categories of physical objects pursued as trophies. Let us now consider another component of recreation, which is more subtle and complex, the feeling of isolation in nature. That this is acquiring a scarcity value that is very high to some persons is attested by the wilderness controversy. Wilderness areas are, by official definition, roadless, with roads built only to their edges. They are thus advertised as unique, as indeed they are. But before long trails are congested, there is pressure for access from the air, or an unexpected fire necessitates splitting an area in two with a road to haul firefighters. Or the congestion induced by publicity may whip up the price of guides and packers, whereupon somebody discovers that the wilderness policy is undemocratic. Or the local chamber of commerce, at first quiescent at the novelty of a hinterland officially labeled as wild, tastes its first blood of tourist money. It then wants more, wilderness or no wilderness. The jeep and the airplane, creatures of the ever-mounting pressure from humanity, thus eliminate the opportunity for isolation in nature. In short, the very scarcity of wild places, reacting with the mores of advertising and promotion, tends to defeat any deliberate effort to prevent their growing still more scarce. It is clear without further discussion that mass use involves a direct dilution of the opportunity for solitude, that when we speak of roads, campgrounds, trails, and toilets as development of recreational resources, we speak falsely in respect to this component. Such accommodations for the crowd are not developing in the sense of adding or creating anything. On the contrary, they are merely water poured into the already thin soup. We now contrast with the isolation component, that very distinct, if simple one, which we may label fresh air and change of scene. Mass use neither destroys nor dilutes this value. The thousandth tourist who clicks the gate to the national park breathes approximately the same air and experiences the same contrast with Monday at the office as does the first. One might even believe that the gregarious assault on the outdoors enhances the contrast. We may say, then, that the fresh air and change of scene component is like the photographic trophy. It withstands mass use without damage. We come now to another component, the perception of the natural processes by which the land and the living things upon it have achieved their characteristic forms, evolution, and by which they maintain their existence, ecology. That thing called nature study, despite the shiver it brings to the spines of the elect, constitutes the first embryonic groping of the mass mind toward perception. The outstanding characteristic of perception is that it entails no consumption and no dilution of any resource. The swoop of a hawk, for example, is perceived by one as the drama of evolution. To another, it is only a threat to the full frying pan. The drama may excite 100 successive witnesses, the threat only one, for he responds with a shotgun. To promote perception is the only truly creative part of recreational engineering. This fact is important in its potential power for bettering the good life only dimly understood. When Daniel Boone first entered into the forests and prairies of the dark and bloody ground, he reduced to his possession the pure essence of outdoor America. He didn't call it that, but what he found is the thing we now seek, and we here deal with things, not names. Recreation, however, is not the outdoors, but our reaction to it. Daniel Boone's reaction depended not only on the quality of what he saw, but on the quality of the mental eye with which he saw it. Ecological science has wrought a change in the mental eye. It has disclosed origins and functions for what to Boone were only facts. It has disclosed mechanisms for what to Boone were only attributes. We have no yardstick to measure this change, but we may safely say that as compared with the competent ecologist of the present day, Boone saw only the surface of things. The incredible intricacies of the plant and animal community, the intrinsic beauty of the organism called America, then in the full bloom of her maidenhood, were as invisible and incomprehensible to Daniel Boone as they are today to Babbitt. The only true development in American recreational resources is the development of the perceptive faculty in Americans. All of the other acts we grace by that name are, at best, attempts to retard or mask the process of dilution. Let no man jump to the conclusion that Babbitt must take his Ph.D. in ecology before he can see his country. On the contrary, the Ph.D. may become as callous as an undertaker to the mysteries at which he officiates. Like all real treasures of the mind, perception can be split into infinitely small fractions without losing its quality. The weeds in a city lot convey the same lesson as the redwoods. The farmer may see in his cow pasture what may not be vouchsafed to the scientist adventuring in the South Seas. Perception, in short, cannot be purchased with either learned degrees or dollars. It grows at home as well as abroad, and he who has a little may use it to as good advantage as he who has much. As a search for perception, the recreational stampede is footless and unnecessary. There is, lastly, a fifth component, the sense of husbandry. It is unknown to the outdoorsman who works for conservation with his vote rather than with his hands. It is realized only when some art of management is applied to land by some person of perception. That is to say, its enjoyment is reserved for landholders too poor to buy their sport, and land administrators with a sharp eye and an ecological mind. The tourist who buys access to his scenery misses it altogether. So also the sportsman who hires the state or some underling to be his gamekeeper. The government, which essays to substitute public for private operation of recreational lands, is unwittingly giving away to its field officers a large share of what it seeks to offer its citizens. We foresters and game managers might logically pay for, instead of being paid for, our job as husbandmen of wild crops. That a sense of husbandry exercised in the production of crops may be quite as important as the crops themselves is realized to some extent in agriculture, but not in conservation. American sportsmen hold in small esteem the intensive game cropping of the Scottish moors and the German forests, and in some respects rightly. But they overlook entirely the sense of husbandry developed by the European landholder in the process of cropping. We have no such thing as yet. It is important. When we conclude that we must bait the farmer with subsidies to induce him to raise a forest, or with gate receipts to induce him to raise game, we are merely admitting that the pleasures of husbandry in the wild are as yet unknown both to the farmer and to ourselves. Scientists have an epigram. Ontogeny repeats phylogeny. What they mean is that the development of each individual repeats the evolutionary history of the race. This is true of mental as well as physical things. The trophy hunter is the caveman reborn. Trophy hunting is the prerogative of youth, racial or individual, and nothing to apologize for. The disquieting thing in the modern picture is the trophy hunter who never grows up, in whom the capacity for isolation, perception, and husbandry is undeveloped or perhaps lost. He is the motorized ant who swarms the continents before learning to see his own backyard, who consumes but never creates outdoor satisfactions. For him, the recreational engineer dilutes the wilderness and artificializes its trophies in the fond belief that he is rendering a public service. The trophy recreationist has peculiarities that contribute in subtle ways to his own undoing. To enjoy, he must possess, invade, appropriate. Hence, the wilderness that he cannot personally see has no value to him. Hence, the universal assumption that an unused hinterland is rendering no service to society. To those devoid of imagination, a blank place on the map is a useless waste. To others, the most valuable part. Is my share in Alaska worthless to me because I shall never go there? Do I need a road to show me the Arctic prairies, the goose pastures of the Yukon, the Kodiak bear, the sheep meadows behind McKinley? It would appear, in short, that the rudimentary grades of outdoor recreation consume their resource base. The higher grades, at least to a degree, create their own satisfactions with little or no attrition of land or life. It is the expansion of transport without a corresponding growth of perception that threatens us with qualitative bankruptcy of the recreational process. Recreational development is a job not of building roads into lovely country, but of building receptivity into the still unlovely human mind. This has been a Highbridge production, read by Mike Chamberlain. Copyright 1966 by Oxford University Press, Inc. Recording copyright 2017 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.